and welcome to the Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Mortazavi in Washington, D.C. Before I begin this episode, I'd like to ask you to consider supporting the Iran Podcast. We need the support of listeners like yourself to be able to continue our work. And this podcast will not be possible without your contribution and support. To support this podcast, you can go to anchor.fm/theIranPodcast. Then click on support this podcast and set up a monthly donation to help us continue our work. Again, that website is anchor.fm/theIranPodcast. Now let me introduce my guest. My guest today is Barbara Slavin, a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center here in Washington, D.C., and also a veteran journalist and an expert on U.S.-Iran relations. Barbara, welcome back to the Iran Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you again. Let's start with an overview of the current state of war, the Israel-Hamas war, obviously in that region, but it's also expanded to multiple other fronts and theaters in the north with Hezbollah. There are skirmishes between U.S. and Shia militia in Iraq. In the Red Sea, the Houthis are shooting at ships. Talk about where we are right now since that attack on October 7th.
Sure. It's not a pretty picture. I mean, the war is now approaching 5 months. It is both the longest and the bloodiest Arab-Israeli war ever. And of course, it's not between Israel and an Arab state or another state. It's between Israel and a non-state actor, Hamas. As we all know, it started when Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th and killed 1,200 Israelis, took another couple hundred hostage. Israel responded in a very, very overpowering way and has now killed many members of Hamas, but also many, many civilians, something like 30,000 people all told. The Israeli attack has also caused immense destruction to infrastructure, schools, hospitals, apartment blocks, mosques, government buildings of all sort. And there's only been one ceasefire, which allowed for the release of some of the Israeli hostages and some Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. There have been efforts to try to get a more durable ceasefire, and they are proceeding, but they, as we're talking today, they have not succeeded yet. And Israel is continuing to bomb and carry out a ground invasion of Gaza, including beginning to enter Rafah, which is now the one part of Gaza where most of the Palestinians who fled other parts of Gaza are concentrated. It's not yet a full-scale operation. The U.S. Government, which has otherwise been fairly supportive of the Israelis, has warned very strongly against a major Israeli ground operation in Rafah. But there are a lot of concerns. The Egyptians are building a kind of buffer zone on their side of the border with a big wall, almost anticipating that Israel will go into Rafah and enforce Palestinians there to flee across the border because there's simply no other place to go. There has been a slight toughening of U.S. language here or there when it comes to Israeli actions, but the U.S. recently vetoed for the third time a U.N. Security Council resolution, which would have demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The U.S. has also sanctioned four Israeli settlers accused of fomenting violence against Palestinians in the West Bank, and some 400 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th. Just as we're speaking, Secretary of State Tony Blinken has put out a statement saying that Israeli settlements in the West Bank are, quote unquote, inconsistent with international law. This has been longstanding U.S. policy, although it was rescinded under the Trump administration. And this comes in reaction to an announcement that the Israelis intend to build 3,000 more settlements in the West Bank. So far from ceasing settlement activity or rolling it back or doing anything that could lay the ground for a two-state solution, the government of Bibi Netanyahu is clearly trying to do everything possible to sabotage that prospect, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. You talked about the regional situation. This is a somewhat better picture. We've not seen a full-scale conflagration between Israel and other Iranian-backed groups like Hezbollah. But we have seen a fair amount of skirmishing. The Houthis, who are 1,000 miles away from Gaza, have begun a campaign of attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. And this has caused the United States and Britain to bomb Yemen and bomb arms depots in Yemen to try to stop the Houthi attacks. So far, that hasn't succeeded. There have also been skirmishes across the Lebanon border between Israel and Hezbollah. And there have been attacks on Americans based in Iraq, Syria, and Jordan by Iran-backed groups. Three American service members were killed in late January by an Iran-backed militia, Iraqi militia. This led to U.S. retaliation, and there has since been a bit of a calm in that arena. But as long as the war goes on, as long as there's no ceasefire, the danger of escalation is always there. And it is truly a horrific situation, certainly from a humanitarian point of view, and from any other point of view. I could also add that there has been action against Israel at the International Criminal Court, which is, the International Court of Justice, I believe it is, which is the highest UN judicial body. And they are considering charges of genocide that were brought against Israel by South Africa, and also holding hearings on the legality of Israeli occupation of both the West Bank and Gaza, which has now gone on for 57 years. So it's quite a picture. Israel is very isolated in the global South and increasingly in Europe, and even to some extent, I think, in the United States as well. The U.S. is also facing pressure because of its support of Israel, and I think that something has to give, or this situation will really become uncontrollable.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, I'll ask you about the regional implications, some of those, the multiple theaters that we talked about, including that U.S. base. I know you had a great piece in the Stimson Center about that. But let me first ask you about U.S. policy, especially the Biden administration. But as you mentioned, this is long-held U.S. policy. How do you assess U.S. policy towards not just Israel in general, but specifically after October 7th, as it's been characterized as a bear hug approach, and then over the past few months we see that it's been changed? How much leverage do you think the U.S. has? Have they used it enough over Bibi Netanyahu and the Israeli war cabinet or not? And overall, what do you think the U.S. can and should do?
I think, you know, initially the response, the bear hug, as you call it, was appropriate. The attacks by Hamas, it wasn't just that they killed more Israelis than have been killed in any incident like this in the history of the Jewish state. It was also the shocking, you know, crimes, the rapes, the killing of children. It just atrocious, the attacks on a music festival that with all these beautiful young people, and of course the abduction of women, children, babies. It was atrocious, and I think it was appropriate for Biden to show this kind of sympathy for Israel. The problem is that once the Israeli retaliation began, Biden didn't show an equivalent amount of empathy for Palestinian victims, many of them civilians. And he even at one point disputed the death tolls that were coming out from Gaza, suggesting that perhaps they'd been inflated. And apparently they have not been inflated. If anything, they may be underestimated. So this was kind of tone deaf. It infuriated certainly a lot of people in the Muslim world. It infuriated a lot of Americans who are of Muslim extraction, Arab extraction, and also a lot of progressives and human rights advocates in the United States who saw a double standard here. Since then, I know that the administration has been trying very hard to get a ceasefire to get the release of remaining hostages. But I think that the messages certainly that are being sent in public are still not tough enough. And as we're speaking, there is still a proposal for Israel to get an additional $14 billion in American arms aid. And Israel already gets $4 billion in weapons aid from the United States every year, and it's gotten some emergency shipments since October 7th. What kind of message does this send? It sends a message that Israel can still act with impunity. And I think that's the wrong message. So I would like to see the U.S. basically say that the Israelis have to stop this offensive, or they will face real consequences, not just rhetorical wrist slaps.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to the regional implications. We know one side of this war is Israel, its biggest supporter, the U.S., Western allies. The other side is initially Hamas, who launched the October 7th attack, but then the rest of these non-state actors across the region, the so-called Axis of Resistance, and ultimately Tehran, or the Islamic Republic in Iran. Talk about these other theaters. So in the north, Israel is involved with Hezbollah, as you mentioned, in Iraq with the Shia militia, and also in the Red Sea. And how each of those do you think is impacting the war or Israel and the U.S.'s calculation?
It's been worrisome. The attacks on American servicemen and so on, that was quite worrisome and tragic. That these people were targeted. And of course, the situation in northern Israel is also very difficult. A lot of Israelis have left their homes there. A lot of Lebanese in southern Lebanon have left their homes and moved away from the border because of these skirmishes, which are continuing. However, they have not escalated to the point where this is an all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah. We haven't seen Israel undertake the sort of attacks that it did back in 2006 when there was an extremely bloody war between Israel and Hezbollah. There have been a couple of moments when I was concerned there was an Israeli assassination of a very prominent Hamas figure in Lebanon, in South Beirut, the area which has been the sanctuary of Hezbollah, where many of its supporters and officials live, but it was contained. And I think the reason is Iran, in part, that the Iranians don't want a wider conflagration. I don't think they can afford it. Their economic situation is very poor. The government is already extremely unpopular for a number of reasons that we can go into. And I think there is a kind of unwritten agreement among all the parties that they will do the minimum required to show solidarity with the Palestinians, but not anything that could get people into a situation from which it would be difficult to emerge unscathed. And so it's a lot of virtue signaling. It's a lot of tit for tat, but not yet, wholesale war. On the other fronts, poor Syria, whenever in doubt, bomb Syria. So we've seen a lot of activity there with attacks by the Israelis on Iranian targets, including a number of generals. And the retaliation comes in the form usually of Iran-backed Iraqi or Syrian groups attacking Americans, or attacking targets in Iraqi Kurdistan. I've compared it to sort of pool bank shots in pool, where you're not really hitting directly where you want to hit. You hit the side and it bounces off, and maybe it hits the target that you really intend to, or maybe not. But you're showing that you're reacting and that you're doing something. And that is almost more important than actually retaliating in kind. There have also been some other weird activities, bombings in Iran, apparently by ISIS-related groups, Muslim extremists, sometimes separatist groups, ethnic separatists from Baluchistan. And Iran actually bombed Pakistan, and Pakistan bombed Iran in retaliation for these strikes. So it was really getting quite crazy and out of hand. And as I mentioned earlier, the longer we go without a ceasefire, the greater the danger that this does expand to the point where it will be difficult to rein in. But so far, as I said, it's virtue signaling, and we haven't seen an expansion into a wider war. The Houthi situation, we will see. The Houthis say that they will stop attacking shipping when there's a ceasefire in Gaza and sufficient humanitarian aid is able to get into Gaza. Their actions have actually been the most costly in terms of the international economy. A drastic reduction in shipping going through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal, which is hurting Egypt most of all because it needs those revenues, and also ordinary consumers who have to pay more for higher shipping mm-hmm. costs. Mm-hmm.
Now, Barbara, I want you to talk about this specific piece that you published at the Stimson Center. It's a little bit detailed, but I think it's very interesting. I haven't heard this this amount of detail elsewhere. If you could just summarize it. It's titled, "What is the U.S. doing in a disputed triangle on the Jordan-Syria-Iraq border?" And it talks about Tower 22, an unspoken secret. That is the U.S. base, and it's precisely where that drone attack by the Iraqi militia targeted and killed three Americans. Can you talk about what this Tower 22 is, its purpose, this unspoken secret?
So I think one of the things that's really interesting is whether in the aftermath of the attack on Tower 22, the U.S. will keep its forces in Iraq and Syria. U.S. has about 2,500 troops in Iraq. And they in turn support about 1,000 American troops in Syria, based in Tanf and two other bases. And Tower 22 has been providing support to Tanf, as we mentioned. So it's all sort of connected. You may remember that Donald Trump tried to pull all of the American forces out of Syria. It led his defense secretary, Jim Mattis, to quit the administration. Things seem to have settled down for now, and there are people in Iraq certainly who want the United States to keep a small presence there as trainers, as anti-ISIS forces potentially, and also as a kind of buffer against a complete Iranian takeover of Iraq. So we will see. But once again, the longer the war goes on in Gaza, the more tension you have all around, the more you see this conflict sort of metastasize into the region. And the sooner the fighting in Gaza ends, the quicker I think we can bring down the level of tension in all these other places.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, we talked about the role of Iran, the axis of resistance, and now that we're talking about the U.S. and some of its allies, let's move to the Arab states. What is the role of the various Arab states in this conflict, how much leverage they have. And especially, I want to talk about the Arab monarchies in the Persian Gulf, the wealthy states who seem to have a lot of leverage, but don't seem to be using a lot of it in this conflict. What do you think is the role of the various Arab states in this situation?
Well, this was an extremely untimely conflict for them because we saw a lot of flirtation on the part of the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, flirting with the notion of normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel. The Biden administration has certainly been very eager to broker that. They would consider that a great achievement. And now, of course, the Saudis cannot be seen to be moving forward with the Israelis while this terrible conflict is continuing. A lot of these countries, the Saudis among them, had sort of patched up relations with Iran, which had been very tense for years. There was a deal brokered last year, in part by the Chinese, that restored normal diplomatic relations between the Saudis and the Iranians. The Emiratis had already done that. So they don't want to get on the wrong side of Iran. They don't want to sort of resuscitate that whole level of tension and conflict. And that makes it very difficult for them to do some of the things I think the United States would like them to do. They don't want to get out ahead of the Palestinians. They don't want to be seen as betraying the Palestinian cause, even though these countries are all authoritarian regimes, they still have to pay a little bit of attention to public opinion, which is very, very strong in support of the Palestinians right now. So they haven't been doing as much as they could. I think the question will be, what do they do when this fighting stops? Do they really step forward to provide reconstruction aid to Gaza? Do they provide peacekeeping troops? Do they really come forward with a formula for a two-state solution, which is kind of this holy grail that's been out there for 30-odd years but somehow never seems to materialize? Do they go back to their regular business with the United States and Israel? All of this remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. And what about the narrative here? You and I were actually at a panel at George Washington University earlier this week. It was an excellent panel with a few other colleagues. But one of the questions we discussed, and I want to talk about it here now, is the war of narratives. We know this is very much a military war on the ground, but it's also an information war, a war of narratives, misinformation on both sides. And one thing that's been really on in front and center is the image, Israel's image, and by extension, the image of the U.S., the double standard that many point out, especially across the global south, the Muslim world, the Arab world, this international rules-based order that the United States has been promoting for years, for decades, the position vis-a-vis Ukraine, Russia's attack on Ukraine, and now the difference or that sort of hypocrisy, as they point to, or the double standard when it comes to the Palestinians. Talk about how this war has impacted Israel's image and by extension, especially the United States.
It's been very damaging for the United States. A lot of, you know, what we do and say is fairly hypocritical. I mean, the U.S. has always cared more about certain places and certain issues than others. And the Ukraine, I mean, you mentioned Ukraine. This is a conflict in Europe with white Europeans, many of them blonde and blue-eyed. And so it has been quite obvious that the U.S. has been much more concerned about the Russian invasion of Ukraine than it has been by a number of other crises around the world, not just what's going on in Gaza. I think of what's going on in Sudan, for example, which is also horrific and barely gets mentioned anymore. So this is all valid. And we talked a little bit about Joe Biden's initial reaction and how he really embraced the Israelis. He did not embrace the Palestinians, obviously, to the same extent. And there is still, you know, an effort by the administration to point out every 2 minutes that this war would not be happening had not, Hamas had this horrific attack on Israel. Well, that is true, but we also have to consider the situation that existed before October 7th, namely the Israeli occupation of both of the West Bank and its, if not occupation, then its encircling of Gaza, its complete control over what and who gets in and out of Gaza, even if it was nominally under the governance of Hamas. So I think it's, again, the longer it goes on, the more Palestinians are killed, the more women and children are killed, the more hunger and disease we see in Gaza, the worse it's going to be for Israel, but it's the worse it's going to be for the United States as Israel's rock-solid ally for all of these years.
Mm-hmm. And what about internal, domestically in the U.S.? We know a lot of U.S. foreign policy, especially towards the Middle East, is also a reflection of U.S. domestic politics. It's an election year. Joe Biden is running against, a potential second Trump presidency. And we know that this double standard and the administration's position towards the Palestinians has impacted their standing within part of their domestic base here in the U.S., the more progressives and also Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. How do you think this is going to impact their chance in the election? Because so far it seems like they're compartmentalizing and they don't seem to be really bothered by that change domestically, or at least don't think that it's going to move the election. But what is your assessment? Do you think this is going to cost Joe Biden a second term of presidency?
Well, that's a very big question, and it's hard to answer now. I would disagree a little. I think the administration actually has been showing some concern. it sent a bunch of fairly high-level emissaries to Michigan, where there is a large Arab-American population, to try to somehow make up for Joe Biden's lack of empathy or initial lack of empathy for Palestinians. Again, a lot will depend on how and when this conflict ends and what follows, whether the administration continues to pay attention to the issue once Israel stops and Hamas stops and releases hostages. But there is a danger that it could cost Biden a couple of swing states, particularly the state of Michigan, and that has to be a concern for him.
And finally, Barbara, if a Republican, let's say Donald Trump for a second term, or any Republican wins the election, how do you think that is going to impact U.S. policy towards the region? How specifically this issue and also the broader region, how is it going to change?
Well, Trump is, if anything, very unpredictable. So I think one thing we can be sure of is that he'll most likely be very concerned about whatever the Saudi point of view is, because he has investments and his son-in-law has lucrative investments involving the Saudis. They provided, I think, $2 billion so that Jared Kushner could start some sort of hedge fund. So he will be very aware of what the Saudis are thinking. But again, that's a little bit hard to predict at this point. Trump was very pro-Israel in his first term, but then apparently was angry with the Israelis for not being sufficiently grateful to him for what he did. So it's difficult to predict. I would think, though, that in general, the chances for a Palestinian state of any kind would be even less, and they're already pretty slim, and that he would probably be even tougher on Iran, although, again, it's hard to imagine what more Trump could do beyond the maximum pressure campaign that we've already seen. I would not expect a great diplomatic outreach to the Iranians. And I think it's also likely at the same time that he would try to withdraw more troops, because that seems to be his impulse.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, Barbara, I want to thank you for coming back on the Iran podcast. Thanks for your time.
You are very welcome. It is a pleasure.
That was Barbara Slavin, a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington. Thank you again for listening to the Iran podcast, and I'd like to ask you to consider supporting this podcast. We need the support of listeners like yourself to be able to continue our work, as this podcast will not be possible without your contribution. To support the podcast, you can go to anchor.fm/theIranPodcast. And then click on support this podcast to set up a monthly donation and help us continue our work. Again, that website is anchor.fm/theIranPodcast. And you can click on support this podcast to set up a monthly donation. Thank you. And until next time, goodbye.